Lecture 31, Ramses the Great, the Later Years.
Welcome back. Remember last time we were talking about Ramses the Great? And I mentioned that Ramses is one of my favorite personalities of all of Egyptian history. I think there's really two reasons for that. One is, he's a great guy. But the other is, we have an awful lot of information about him, so we can know something about him, and he gets to become a human being. He ruled for 67 years, so that's plenty of time to build up a kind of dossier, a resume. And last time we talked about the early years. And the two things I stressed was, one, Ramses as a warrior, that, remember the Battle of Kadesh in year 5, he marches out and fights the Hittites at Kadesh. He doesn't win, but he certainly distinguishes himself. He holds off the troops by himself, he says. And eventually at the end, he was offered a peace treaty, and he refuses it. He's only willing to take a truce because he's going to be back. So Ramses is a warrior. There's no question about it, at least in his early years. Then I also tried to show Ramses as a builder. Remember, he built the incredible temple at Abu Simbel with those 67-foot-high statues of Ramses himself. It was a great piece of propaganda so that anybody coming north from Nubia would have to go right by it, and you see these statues of Ramses. And then if you got off the boat and you went inside the temple, what do you see? Nubians as bound captives. Pretty impressive stuff. But that was Ramses in the early years. I want to talk about the later years today. There's a bit of a mystery about Ramses. After this incredible start, really kind of an aggressive start, you know, going to build, going to fight, Ramses has what we might call today a midlife crisis. His personality changes radically. He becomes more sedentary, and we're not exactly sure why. But today I want to trace the latter years of my man Ramses the Great. And I also want to show you how, when you rule for 67 years and you're a powerful pharaoh, what kind of resources are available to you to build your tomb in the Valley of the Kings? You see, we're all familiar with Tutankhamun's tomb because that had all the goodies stuffed in it. But Tutankhamun was a relatively minor king, ruling for only 10 years. What about Ramses, who's Ramses the Great and ruled for 67 years? So we'll talk about how a pharaoh with real resources can prepare for the next life. Let's start with Ramses as a warrior. Now, Kadesh is behind him. He's distinguished himself at the Battle of Kadesh. He has carved it on temple walls. Everybody knows he's a great warrior. But he marches out again. In year 8, he marches out to Syria again. Once again, he's going to Syria. A long haul. And he does pretty well. I mean, it's successful. But he doesn't conquer Kadesh. You know, he comes back, but he hasn't conquered Kadesh, which is an interesting thing. Now, the reason he had to march out again, and the Egyptians marched out again and again and again, was that, remember, they never had an occupying force. When they conquered a country, they didn't leave, say, a garrison of 2,000 soldiers to make sure these people stayed in line and paid their taxes or whatever. No, Egyptians never wanted to live on foreign soil, because if they died on foreign soil, they might not be mummified, and they'd lose their chance at immortality. So because they never left a kind of colony in any country, they had to go back every year if they wanted the tribute. And that's what happens. Ramses marches out again and again. But year 8, goes to Syria, does okay, but doesn't capture Kadesh. Now, in year 21 of Ramses' reign, he's been reigning for 21 years now, right? He's in his 40s, right? Just about in his 40s. He signs a treaty with the Hittite king. He signs the Hittite treaty. Now remember, at Kadesh he wasn't willing to sign a treaty, right? It's, nope, maybe a temporary truce. And the treaty is an interesting document. The Hittites really needed it. They needed this treaty. They were fighting the Assyrians. And they couldn't really battle Assyrians and Egyptians at the same time. So it's understandable, from the Hittite point of view, we need a treaty. But this is just the very time when Ramses, you might think, would march out and defeat the Hittites. They've divided the forces. They've got to fight the Assyrians. They're going to fight us. But no, Ramses accepts it. For some reason, in the 21st year of Ramses' reign, this great warrior says, no more war. It's a very interesting document, by the way. We don't have the original version of it that the Hittites sent. But the Egyptians were pretty impressed with it. It came on a silver tablet, right? It was a silver tablet inscribed in cuneiform. Now, cuneiform is not a language. It's a script. In other words, all cuneiform means is wedge-shaped writing. So it was usually made with a stylus. You had a little triangular stylus, and you impressed it on something, usually clay, and that's cuneiform. But you could write many languages in this script. In the same way, we use the exact same letters for French, Spanish, English, right? A T still looks like a T. It's the same with cuneiform. You could use cuneiform for lots of different languages. So the people who lived in the city of Akkad, they wrote in Akkadian. The Sumerians who lived in Sumer wrote in Sumerian. But they all used the same letters, the cuneiform script. So this tablet, the silver tablet, comes to Ramses the Great. And the Egyptians, when they wrote their translation of it, and Ramses put it on temple walls. It's on the wall at Abu Simbel, his temple that he built with the huge statues. It's on the wall at Karnak Temple, the Vatican of ancient Egypt. So he has several versions of this thing that he translated. And one of the things he says, and he says, you know, it came on a silver tablet with seals and stuff. So they were kind of impressed with just the way it looked. It looked like a different kind of document for them. Now, it has everything that you would expect from a superpower agreement. Two superpowers making an agreement. It's got non-aggression pact, you know. I'm not going to go on your territory, you don't go on mine. It's got mutual support clauses. If I'm attacked, you'll help me. If you're attacked, I'll help you. It's got even trade agreements. It's the kind of, I think, it's probably the first peace treaty in the history of the world that we have. I mean, it's a real document. Just to give you a feeling for it, I'll read you one little part of it, and you'll get a feeling for how these guys talked about, let's make peace. Now, remember the Hittites. The land of the Hittites was called Hatti. Hatti, that's where we get Hittites from. The great ruler of Hatti shall never trespass against the land of Egypt to take anything from it. Ramses shall never trespass against the land of Hatti to take anything from it. If some other foe should come against the territories of Ramses, and he sends word to the great ruler of Hatti, saying, come with me as an ally against him, then the great ruler of Hatti shall act with him and shall slay his foes. And so shall Ramses for Hattusil, that's the king. As for him who shall keep these terms on the silver tablet, Hittites or Egyptians, the thousands of gods of Hatti and the thousands of gods of Egypt will cause him to flourish, will make him to live together with his household, with land and his servants. So if you follow this treaty, be you a noble or the king, you're going to prosper. So it's an important document. And I think, in a sense, it marks a turning for Ramses' career. He's not ready to do battle anymore. He's turned from a hawk to a dove, essentially. And you might wonder why. It's quite interesting. Now, the next sign that Ramses has really changed, kind of mellowed in his old age, comes in year 34. Now, he's in his 50s now, right? And Ramses marries a Hittite bride. Right? A Hittite, I mean, these guys were the enemies up until the treaty. Now he's marrying a Hittite bride. This is usually done not out of love. He undoubtedly never saw her when he made the deal. You know, this is 800 miles to the north in modern Turkey, and he's there. But it cements a deal. It sort of puts the two countries on a kind of equal footing, and he's going to marry a Hittite bride. And he talks about her dowry. Right? Now, Ramses kind of has to boast no matter what happens. So, for example, if he's going to sign a treaty, it's out of his magnanimous gesture that he's letting this poor guy from the Hittites sign a treaty with him. Same with this bride, the Hittite bride. He says her dowry will be greater than the king of Babylon's daughter. Right? So this is big time. And it was a big dowry, undoubtedly. I mean, Egypt was the power in the Middle East. So when this young girl, probably, right? She's got to be a beauty or else it's not going to be sent. When this young girl comes to Ramses, she is coming with gold and silver and horses and jewels. I mean, she's coming with stuff. And it's a long haul. It's 800 miles, you know, roughly. So she is coming with an entourage. This is going to be an armed guard. This is a major event, a Hittite princess coming to marry Ramses the Great. And, you know, one of the things that you got out of a deal like this was things that you didn't have. For example, Egypt did not have precious stones. That's a common misconception. There is not a single precious stone in Egypt. There are no diamond, ruby, emerald mines at all. But not only that, there were certain kinds of semi-precious stones that Egypt didn't have. For example, lapis. And these guys could come with lapis. So a marriage like this was a source of things not easily acquired, a source of the luxuries that makes life worth living. So Ramses was pretty happy about this deal, we can be sure. And he even carved an inscription on his temple about this marriage. And you know what amazed everybody the most? He describes the bride coming, and he's pleased with her. She is more beautiful than anything. Just, this is just kind of stock stuff. You had to say it, you know, to show that Ramses was really getting a good deal. Remember, he always had his favorite wife, Nefertari. I mean, she was really the apple of his eye. I mean, if you'll remember, over the temple at Abu Simbel, he said, Nefertari, she for whom the sun doth shine. I mean, Nefertari was really his sweetie. But so she's got, and she's not bothered by this young princess coming. She's not bothered. This is a political marriage. But he had to say she was beautiful, etc. But the thing that really amazed them all, and he wrote it on the temple wall, it says, Hittite soldiers and Egyptian soldiers sat down to eat, face to face, not fighting. I mean, it was amazing that, I mean, apparently all the soldiers were amazed at this, that, you know, for years, the Hittites had been the traditional enemies. And here you are, the princess has come, and obviously with a small army to guard her, and now that this Hittite army is banqueting with the Egyptian army. Face to face, not fighting, was the phrase. And it was incredible. See, Egypt had nine traditional enemies. They were called the nine bows. And, you know, the Hittites were one of them. And I'll say something neat when you go to a museum. If you look at a statue of a king of this period, the New Kingdom as we call it, and if the statue is one seated, a seated statue where the king or queen is seated, look beneath the feet. Usually what you see beneath the feet of the statue are nine bows. In other words, the pharaoh is seated, stepping on the enemy. It's a kind of symbolic gesture. But when you go to a museum in the Egyptian collection, look at the feet, and you'll very often see nine bows. It's not clear what they are, but now that you know, you'll see. Oh, yeah, they're bows and bow and arrow. So this is a big deal for the Hittite army, to be eating with the Egyptian army and they're not slugging it out. It was a big deal. There's another indication, by the way, that this Ramses is softening, at least certainly to the Hittites, and he doesn't march out against anyone else either. The king of the Hittites sends a letter to Ramses. Hattusilus is the king's name. Now remember, Ramses is going to reign for 67 years. That is a long haul. So he's going to outlive an awful lot of Hittite kings, Syrian kings. He's going to outlive everybody. So the new king writes him and says, you know, my sister can't have children, can't conceive. Will you send me an Egyptian physician to see if he can help with this problem? Now, again, Egypt, of course, was viewed as having the best of all physicians. You remember in Egypt, medicine was called the necessary art. And they were, as far as I know, the first to have specialists. For example, they had eye doctors. They had gynecologists, men who specialized in women's diseases. And they were usually men who were physicians. We know of one woman physician, an interesting woman, I think her name is Peshat. She was in the Old Kingdom during the time of Sneferu, way back when in the Old Kingdom, and she was the royal physician. So in the early part, there was a woman who was the royal physician. But almost always, the physicians are men. So because Egypt has these specialists, right, gynecologists, perhaps this man can help the sister conceive. So just the fact that the Hittite king is writing to Ramses and saying, say, hey, old boy, you know, send me a physician. Ramses' reply is great. I mean, he is funny. He says, basically, I know your sister. She's 50 if she's a day. But I'll send a physician anyway. Right? It is also interesting that since the woman can't conceive, the assumption, of course, is that it's her fault, that the reason they're not having children is the woman's problem, right? You don't know exactly what they really thought about conception. How did it happen? It was a relatively mysterious event, occurrence. You know, even until the Middle Ages, in our time, our Middle Ages, conception wasn't really fully understood. I mean, that's why midwives were sometimes looked, you know, it was the kind of thing that women did. You had midwives, and it was a woman's thing, and midwives weren't that well educated very often. So conception is a curious thing. So it wasn't until, and I think that's probably where you get witches becoming more important than warlocks or whatever the male counterpart is, because women did these cunning things having to do with birth and stuff like that, and they had their own realm, so they were a little looked at suspiciously. But this physician is going to be sent, and he'll do what he can do. We have no idea what happens. Undoubtedly, nothing, you know. But the physician is sent. So Ramses is mellow. Hittite king is kind of very happy with him. They're getting along. And in year 44 or so of Ramses' reign, this is, Ramses is now in his 60s, but think about it. He'd been ruling for 44 years. He's got another 23 years to go or so. Right? He's going to keep going. Anyway, in year 44, he marries another Hittite bride. Right? Takes another one. I think this further establishes peace. What we're getting is, this is so established that these two countries are at peace with each other. Two Hittite brides, sending physicians, treaties on the temple walls. I mean, think about it. You carved a treaty on a temple wall. It was up there forever. It wasn't like a piece of paper. You could put it away and forget about it. So I think Ramses is mellowing. And it may not be just old age, you know, because it started fairly early. Now, let me say some things about Ramses' personal life, not just his political aspirations or lack of. Ramses experienced a lot of deaths in his family, which is, understand this, he had about 100 children. Right? Naturally, he had more than one wife. You know, he had two great, he had Nefertari, had another great important wife, he's Nofret, loads of wives. Had something like 52 sons. And if you have that many children, in an ancient country where death is not unusual at an early age, you can experience a death probably every year. One of your kids, one of your wives, is going to die. Right? And Ramses had a lot of personal tragedy. I mean, you can't think about it, oh, he's got 100 kids, so it doesn't matter. Certainly there are people who care, people who matter to Ramses. And he's experiencing them. And I think the big one happens around year 20 of his reign. His beloved Nefertari dies. She dies just about the time that they make their trip to Abu Simbel to dedicate the temples. Now remember, at Abu Simbel, which is south of Egypt's border at Aswan, Ramses built not one temple, but two. One is his great temple, where he's shown the four statues, the 67-foot height statues. But as you're facing it from the water, to the right is Nefertari's temple. He built an entire huge temple carved out of the mountain for Nefertari, where he puts this wonderful inscription, "She for whom the sun doth shine." Well, they complete the temple about Ramses' 20th year. And Nefertari makes the trip down, and we never hear about her again, which means she died. You don't get like a formal announcement, the queen is dead, the king is dead. You never do that, or the prince is dead. That never happens. In a sense, it was viewed as darkness triumphing over light, in a sense. So you didn't really talk about it. The way we figure out when somebody dies is when they disappear from the historical record. And after year 20, there's no more Nefertari. So that's a big blow to Ramses, undoubtedly. It's interesting, by the way, that right after her death, he signs the Hittite Treaty. Right? She dies in year 20, and the Hittite Treaty is signed about year 21. So there may be a connection between the two events. You know, it may have taken some steam out of his sails, maybe. You know? Tell you a funny thing about Abu Simbel, by the way, because that's a source of our information about Ramses. Now, I can't prove this. I'm just sort of saying it off the top of my head. But my bet is that Mount Rushmore was patterned after Abu Simbel. That you've got these colossal heads of our rulers carved into a mountain. You know, I would bet that Mount Rushmore, really, the inspiration for it, comes from Abu Simbel. Interestingly, by the way, it took the same number of years, roughly, to complete the two monuments, Abu Simbel and Mount Rushmore. So there's a difference, and it's not, to be fair, Mount Rushmore is like granite, you know, and this is a softer stone in Egypt. But to be fair also, we had pneumatic tools, we had drills and things like that. But I think Mount Rushmore may have been inspired by Ramses the Great. You know, great men have the great monuments. But Nefertari is not the only one to die during Ramses' reign, of course. Remember Ramses' firstborn son, Amun-Her-Kepshef was his name, and the name means Amun is upon my sword. A Kepshef is a kind of sickle sword, right? So it shows also that Amun is an important god. Well, Amun-Her-Kepshef, who is really what we would call the crown prince, he's the eldest son who hopefully will eventually become king. He dies We think around year 17 of Ramses' reign, so a little before Nefertari. Now, the reason is when various announcements are sent out to the world about various events, it almost always includes, and the king's eldest son is. And Amenherkepshef is no longer the king's eldest son in later announcements. So we think Ramses loses his firstborn son sometime around, you know, just before the completion of Abu Simbel, around year 17. Another blow to Ramses, undoubtedly. You know, the crown prince has to be the apple in dad's eye because he's being groomed to become king of Egypt. So this was a blow. There's other blows to Ramses. For example, remember the son Chaiamwasit? Now the name there means something like rising in Thebes or shining in Thebes. Remember, Thebes was called Waset. That was the ancient name for it, meaning the scepter, power. And Chaiamwasit was that overachiever son that we talked about last time. He is the first archaeologist in history. He puts labels on pyramids because he's afraid that the builders of the pyramid, now the pyramids are of course 1,000 years old now, and he is afraid that the builders of the pyramids will be forgotten, that we won't know who built this pyramid, who built that. Because remember, most of the pyramids are uninscribed until we get to the 5th dynasty. So he goes around putting labels, museum labels, on pyramids. So he's really an archaeologist. But he's also the high priest of Memphis. And a very important title. Memphis is the capital of Egypt now, right? The administrative capital is in the north, Memphis. Thebes is in the south. And Chaiamwasit does other things, remember. He also is the one who starts building the Serapeum, this maze of tombs for the Apis bull. But we'll talk about that in detail later. But Chaiamwasit is really, you know, a doer. He dies. So we're getting an awful lot of deaths in Ramses' family, which is quite normal. When you have 100 kids, God knows how many wives, you're going to experience these things. And some of them are going to be very close to you, and you're going to feel it. So I tend to get the feeling of Ramses as a man who's taken his knocks. It's not the famous Mel Brooks line, it's great to be king. Sometimes it's not so great to be king. Now, Ramses turns his attention, I think, away from building temples. I mean, he's a great builder. It's in his blood. But I think he turns it towards building tombs. This is where Ramses' sort of mindset is in the next world, towards death. And the first thing I'd like to talk about with Ramses as a tomb builder is Nefertari's tomb, his beloved wife who dies around year 20. She's buried in the Valley of the Queens. The ancient name for the Valley of the Queens was the place of beauty. And Nefertari's tomb, I think everybody agrees, is perhaps the most beautiful tomb in all of Egypt. It's interesting trying to figure out why. You know, it's not clear. I think it's partly that the background is painted a very clear white. Most tombs don't have this white background. But it's certainly beautiful. And it was restored. You know, there are problems with the tombs in the Valley of the Kings, the Valley of the Queens. The problem is salt. Salt crystals. You know, the water table has changed in Egypt since the Aswan Dam. Water is rising, goes up into the stone. And what happens is salt in the stone migrates to the surface in the form of crystals. And it breaks through the plaster, the painting, and the plaster starts to flake off. Well, we were fortunate with the tomb of Nefertari, which was in terrible shape. The most beautiful tomb in Egypt was closed for many, many years. Many years. And then the Getty Institute, you know, John Paul Getty's famous museum, also has a conservation division. And they do things around the world, gratis, for free, just because it's a good thing to do. And, you know, thank God they've got more money than anybody. And they went, and for years, they had a team of Italians, mainly, working on the tomb of Nefertari. They basically took the plaster off the wall and piece by piece picked out the salt crystals that had migrated to the surface, then put a sealant, and then put the plaster back. I mean, a remarkable job. And then the question was, the big debate, should we paint in the places that are missing? And they did a kind of interesting experiment. They had a section of the tomb where they put in the painting that was missing. They could have done it so you'd never know. They could have done it just like the Egyptian and you'd never be able to see it. But they decided not to. So whenever they put in a restoration, they put a little cross-hatching, very fine, just so you can tell this is new. And eventually they decided not to do it with the whole tomb. They decided to just restore it as best they can. And it's now open to the public. It's not easy to get into in this sense. First of all, it's an expensive tomb. Most tombs in Egypt are very inexpensive. This one, I believe, is now 100 Egyptian pounds, which is about $30 to get into. So that's a lot of money in Egypt, and it's the most expensive of all tombs, but it's worth it. And they're trying to keep down the volume of people in it. When I last saw it, they were only selling about 100 tickets per day. Because any time a tourist goes into a tomb, you are perspiring, and you are giving off water into the atmosphere. You are changing the humidity of the tomb. And that is, in a sense, leading to its destruction. So they have to control the number of people in this tomb. The Getty even suggested after they fixed it, after they restored it, that it be closed permanently. Interesting, just restoring it to have it for the heritage, but not for people to see. And I think eventually it may be closed, but it's a beautiful tomb, and Ramses built this for his beloved Nefertari. Now, that, of course, isn't the only one he's got to worry about. He's got 52 sons. What about Amenherkepchef? What about Chaim Wasit? Chaim Wasit may have been buried in the north. We think he may have been buried in the Serapeum. We're not sure. But what about all these other sons? And this is where the famous KV5 comes in, the tomb in the Valley of the Kings that has been called KV5. You know, as I mentioned once before, every tomb is numbered. And Kings Valley 5 is the tomb that Ramses built for his sons. It was discovered, really, in the early part of the 19th century. Then it was lost. It was covered over. How does it get covered over? How does the tomb get covered over? There are occasional rainstorms in the Valley of the Kings. Infrequent. But when they come, boulders practically come rushing down through the valley and rush into open tombs. So this tomb became blocked up, obliterated, and lost. It was rediscovered in 1987 by Dr. Kent Weeks, who was with the American University in Cairo. Weeks is in charge of a very important project, the Theban Mapping Project. Believe it or not, there is no modern map of the Valley of the Kings, no modern map which accurately pinpoints and diagrams all the tombs. Kent Weeks has been doing this for 20 years, trying to do the most accurate map possible. It's an important project. And as part of his project, he knew that there was supposed to be this tomb, but he had to go find it. So he rediscovered it in 1987, and they all got quite a shock when they went into it. They had to crawl in. The debris was so high that they had to crawl in on their bellies. They only had probably about 3 feet between the ceiling and the top of the debris, and they're crawling in, two of them actually. The first was Kent Weeks and another Egyptologist, Catherine Rarig. They crawled in, and they could see that there was a pillared hallway, and eventually they started clearing the tomb because they had to diagram it, and that's when they got their shock. It's the largest tomb in all of Egypt. It has hundreds of rooms, hundreds, and it's on several levels. I've been in the tomb only once. It's a little bit dangerous. It's not structurally sound. And I've been in it once, and it just, you feel disoriented. It's not like any other tomb I've ever been in, because you got all these rooms, and then you go down another level, and you go back under, and there's more tombs. And the question is, what are all these rooms used for? One possibility is these are chapels where offerings could be made to the sons of Ramses, and then perhaps beneath will be the tombs of the sons. They have found objects that indicate this was used for a burial. Pieces of coffins, pieces of the canopic jars, the jars that held the internal organs. This will be a very difficult excavation. Weeks has been working on it now for years. And you have to take out the debris, and it's like cement. And also, you can't just remove it all at once. You're going to change the humidity and the climate in the tomb, and walls are going to start moving. So this is an excavation that I think will probably take more than 100 years. They will probably have to clear one room, let the tomb stabilize, bring in the engineers to shore up the ceiling so they don't fall on you, and then maybe wait another 10 years, excavate a little bit. So it's more than a lifetime project, but this is probably it certainly is the largest tomb in the Valley of the Kings, and Ramses built it for his sons. Ramses also had to build his own tomb. Now, with all these tombs being built, Ramses needed an entire city of workmen. And there is a city of the workmen called Deir el-Medina, which is not far from the Valley of the Kings, and we know more about this city than any other ancient city in the world, because they left little notes to each other. We have potsherds with inscriptions on it. So we know how they constructed a tomb. We know that they had a right-hand gang and a left-hand gang for Ramses' tomb. One guys would work on the right-hand wall, others would work on the left-hand wall. And we even know things like, for example, their bronze chisels, they were weighed, at the beginning of the week and at the end of the week so nobody could steal any bronze, because bronze was valuable. So you got your chisels, and they were weighed at the beginning and at the end. Kind of like in the old days when people used to shave the edges of gold coins to get a little bit, when gold coins were in circulation, you'd shave the edge of maybe 1,000 coins, you'd have a little pile of gold. So they were weighed. Now, Ramses had an entire city working on these tombs. And Ramses' tomb, of course, is huge. It's terribly damaged, unfortunately, but it's huge. And my hunch is that Ramses, the burial chamber of Ramses the Great, probably held more treasure than any other room in the ancient world ever held. Think about Tutankhamun. 10 years to stuff it. Ramses had 67 years. So when Ramses died, he is buried in a major tomb. Now, what I'd like to do next time is talk about why did Ramses have this midlife crisis? And the Exodus may have something to do with it. I'll see you then.